Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello. Welcome to New Books in German Studies, a channel in the New Books Network of Podcasts. I'm Michael O'Sullivan of Marist College, one of the co-hosts of this podcast. Today, we're very lucky to have Jason Lutz as a guest. He's a renowned cartoonist and graphic novelist. And today we're going to discuss his book entitled Berlin. It appeared with Drawn and Quarterly in 2019. However, this book actually represents a compilation of three different graphic novels published from 2001 until 2018 as a trilogy. The book, Berlin, is a masterful narrative about mostly fictional characters that captures the realities of political, cultural, and social life during the tragic final phases of the Weimar Republic. This book won numerous awards, and this is a just result for over two decades of work. For example, Lutz cleaned up at the 2019 Excellence in Graphic Literature Awards, where this book received not only the prize for Book of the Year, but also, and I think this will be interesting to a lot of our listeners, the best in educational comics in the category of fiction for adults. Also, a real point of pride is the book won the 2019 Vermont Book Award. For those teacher scholars out there in the audience, this book received a very positive review in the American Historical Review as well. So on a personal note, I read Berlin in the earliest days of the pandemic. I had received the book during the holiday season at the end of 2019 and hadn't had a chance to read it until then. I had a couple of weeks at the start of the pandemic where I wasn't teaching. And I was reading it as I was shifting a course about modern Germany from an on-the-ground format into an online format. Needless to say, the book really spoke to me in the context of and some of the angst associated with those early days of the pandemic, and I'm really going to consider it seriously in future courses. So without any further preamble, hello, Jason. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. To start, I was wondering if you could discuss how you became a graphic novelist, first of all. I think that'll be really interesting to a lot of our listeners. But on New Books in German Studies, we're all going to be really interested to know how you got interested in the Weimar Republic, especially. You created this novel, and it really successfully depicts many aspects of 1920s Berlin. And Jason, I have to say, it leaves a lot of us academic historians a little bit envious. You know, we think we're the people who know how to write history, but you have a format here that is so much more multifaceted than the way most of us write. So I have to admit to a little professional jealousy for how you captured the era. But I think the audience would love to know, you know, how did you get into creating graphic narratives, first of all, and what were the origins of this German history project?
To the first question, I grew up reading and making comics. I mean, I remember from a very, very early age, before I could even, before I could write, I was copying like old Avengers comics and my mom was lettering them for me. So before I could even form letters, I was copying comics down, and it was a kind of interest and a love that persisted through high school. And then and my earliest influences were things like Tintin. There's a big European influence in the form of Hergé's Tintin books, and It was sort of Tintin plus mainstream American superhero and Western comics. Those were my kind of earliest influences. And when it came time to apply to college, I thought that I could I was a fairly decent, I was interested in creative stuff. So I loved to write as well as draw. But I think I conceived of them as sort of two different, areas of expertise, and that in order to go study, beyond high school, I should choose one of them. And I figured that I was a better artist than I was a writer. So I applied to, only one school. I applied to the Rhode Island School of Design, because I was totally, you know, kind of not prepared for college. Didn't do any of my any of the foundational work necessary. But luckily, I got in, and I deferred, worked for a year to save up money, and I ended up going to RISD. And when I did that, I gave up comics. I thought, okay, now it's time to get serious about art and be like a fine artist and study, you know, do the things, do make the kind of art that adults are supposed to make. So put aside childish things, is how I thought of it. And very quickly, I think within the first year there, which was an amazing first year, it was a great experience. I just got exposed to all these other, you know, ways of making art and different forms of expression. I quickly realized that I really did want to tell stories, and I didn't want to, you know, the closest I could get outside of comics was like either illustration, commercial illustration, or kind of narrative painting. But I found myself drawn back to comics. And so I started up a student comic book and worked with a bunch of fellow first and second year students there to do stuff. There were no classes taught, no classes were teaching comics. But I and, you know, maybe a dozen like-minded people were really into it. So we started doing that. And then I kind of never looked back. And I graduated in 1991, got a job as a production assistant at a comic book publisher. And through that kind of got a view into the whole independent alternative comic scene. So step by step, I kind of worked my way into being a professional, which was very hand-to-mouth, very kind of starving artist kind of process. And shortly, let's see, around 1994 or early 90s, I started to draw a weekly strip for a paper in Seattle, Washington called The Stranger, which is a alternative weekly that's still going today. And I wanted to do a long form comics story, which I'd never done before. And I chose kind of portmanteau title. I called it Jar of Fools, which had no particular meaning, but it was kind of like a suggestive title that I thought I could have a lot of fun improvising within. And then week to week, one page at a time, I drew this long, ongoing, serialized, improvised story. And by the end of 2 years, I had a little graphic novel. All those pages were collected and they were published as a book. So I finished that book. And during that book, it was also my kind of self-education and self, I sort of built up my understanding of the medium and came to sort of grips with who I was, what my capabilities were as an artist and a writer. And I got to the end of it, and it was a very satisfying experience. And I was super excited about the medium and about the possibilities. Like I felt like I finally had come to the understanding that comics were just words and pictures. They didn't need the baggage of all the genres that had popularized the art form. At root, it was just this kind of really simple form of expression. And once I got to that point, I realized I could tell any kind of story I wanted to. And the idea was super exciting to me, but I was also like, I don't know what I was, like 24, and didn't really have much to say. you know, in the sense, you know, I hadn't lived much of a life yet. And it's kind of a classic problem of creative people in their early 20s where, you know, you have all this energy, but you don't necessarily know how to know what you want to articulate with it. So I was in that state of mind where I was like, oh my God, like I could do any kind of comic I want to. I could do like a science fiction comic. I could do an adventure comic. What's it going to be? And I was leafing through an issue of The Nation magazine, and I came across an ad, like a half page advertisement one day just at random. And the ad was for a book called Bertolt Brecht's Berlin, which was just a kind of scrapbook of photos with a very kind of cursory visual look at the at Berlin in the 20s. And I just read the ad copy, and there was one line in the ad copy that was something I've tried to track down this ad since, and I haven't been able to find it. But in my memory, there's this one line that went, and the jazz bands played on as the world spun out of control. And that was such an evocative idea, image, that I read that and I said, that's it. That's what I'm going to do. That's my next book. And it's going to be 600 pages long. And I made that decision before I knew anything about the subject matter beyond. I really didn't know anything about Berlin beyond, you know, I'd read a little bit of Isherwood and I think I'd seen like half of Cabaret, right? So I like really had no clear idea of what was happening. I didn't know what the Weimar Republic was. Like I had no idea. Sure. So I saw this ad for this book and I thought, that's it. For better or for worse, since then, I've learned that all of my creative decisions have to do with a kind of random impulse that I follow to the bitter end. And in this case, that impulse, I followed it for 22 years. So I made that decision. And as I was wrapping up this book, the Star of Fools book, and getting it ready for publication, I started researching Berlin. So to answer the second part of your question, the original feeling was totally impulsive. It felt at random to me, right? But of course, all of your impulses, especially creative impulses, are driven by some kind of unconscious need or desire that you don't really understand necessarily at first. And it took me a long time to figure that out. And over the years, what I realized is that a couple of things were happening. One was, I grew up on the West Coast in California. I grew till the age of 10 in Montana, and then high school, junior high and high school was in California in the Bay Area. So very far away from the East Coast, very far away from Europe, very far away from like Jewish culture and history. I'm not Jewish. I had friends who were, but I wouldn't have known because in California at the time, it wasn't like something people talked about really. But there was a point in my high school history education where the history teacher who was fond, just as an aside, of going, getting a Slurpee from the 7-Eleven and pouring a fifth of vodka into it during class. So this was a man who was not happy with his job, and my heart goes out to him now. But one day when we were covering World War II and the Holocaust, he put a VHS cassette in the VCR and left to go get his Big Gulp. And I, whose experience of World War II up until that point had been war movies on television, and maybe some comics, you know, maybe Sergeant Rock or some American comics that kind of treated the war in a very kind of, you know, broad and glorified way. In short order, I was watching black and white footage of bodies being bulldozed into trenches and trying to figure out how that fit into my understanding of that era. I mean, I knew very vaguely, and if my memory is right, I knew vaguely that this terrible thing had happened, but World War II in my conception of it was just about, you know, the battles and the liberation of Europe, and there wasn't a whole lot of information about what the Nazis had really been up to. So it kind of, I think, and that was it. That was high school, and then I went to art school, right? So I think on an unconscious level, I had this deep need to understand the circumstances leading up to that. Like how, you know, after I saw that, then I went to RISD, and there I did my own homework and read more and watched more. And I was on the East Coast at that point. I knew people who were Jewish, whose like grandparents had, you know, survived the concentration camps and that kind of thing. So in that way, I kind of learned more about the situation. And in retrospect, looking back at this impulsive decision, I think that on some level, I was just trying to educate myself. Like I really wanted to know, I really wanted to understand the circumstances leading up to that. Like what, how do human beings do that to each other? Why did this happen at this particular time and place? So that is my long and multi-level response to that question.
Yeah. Thank you. And it's very interesting to hear how kind of, you know, you were operating on two different levels, that on the one hand, this topic was kind of an impulsive decision, but on the other, there was a lot of depth that lay beneath that on the surface. But I do want to follow up a little bit and ask about how you researched the book. I mean, you captured the era really well, and you got a very impressive bibliography at the end. But can you talk about the resources that helped you the most as you kind of depicted 1920s Berlin And particularly, are there any, you know, either historians or other artists that you'd like to kind of shout out here as major influences?
Yeah, well, I did about, so this was like, I think I started the first book and like, I think the first chapter came out in 96. So I think wow. I did about 2 years of research, just reading everything I could lay my hands on. This is before the internet was really a resource. And so I would go to all the used bookstores in Seattle and go to all the libraries and just find everything I could about German history, European history. And I the only rule I've made for myself is that I didn't want to read anything about what happened after 1933. Like, I wanted to immerse myself in what the time period was like for the people who were living then. So I didn't want to have any understanding. I didn't want to take in too much information from after Hitler became chancellor, because I wanted, you know, to try to keep that that period before that kind of intact in my brain. So very quickly, I realized the hardest thing was finding images of stuff that wasn't what you'd find on a postcard, right? Like, there's plenty of paintings and photographs of the cathedrals and the landmarks, but there's not a whole lot when it comes to working class apartments or back alleys and that kind of thing. And that's the stuff I really needed, because I really wanted to get into the street level lives of these people. So the greatest resource ended up being a lot of paintings and drawings by artists working at the time who might be making some form of social commentary through their drawing, but just incidentally, you know, their subject would be in a situation where I could see what a back alley looked like. Oh, it's like filled with firewood, or, you know, what the kind of fencing that might go around a public park, or what a public urinal looked like all these little background details that I just could find, you know, in paintings or drawings or photographs that weren't about those things, but those things happened to show up in them. Those were very, very valuable. There was no single source that was great for that. Although the drawings of George Grosz were very compelling, really hard to use his art as a kind of basis for realistic rendering, because
I can imagine.
Yeah, the expressionism there, you have no idea what kind of proportions, you know, that kind of ladder back chair somebody's sitting in. I'm not really sure if that, you know, it has that narrow of a look to it. So his work I found more inspirational from an emotional perspective. But and there were little details like clothing and, you know, suspender buttons and stuff like that, which I could draw from. But it was this interesting kind of active imagination where I would gather as much visual material as possible, and then I'd have to kind of picture or extrapolate what might be in between things. You know, as much as possible, hewing to that, you know, I could the more I could point the actual reference, the more confident I felt. But there were definitely times when I was making stuff up visually. And in other ways too, obviously, it's an active imagination. There's only so much I can get out of books written in English. I don't read German. So I was limited in that way. In terms of books that I read, I think the two biggest ones that were big for me was there's something called the Weimar Republic Sourcebook.
Yeah.
Which is a collection of essays and articles and manifestos from the time by people living at the time. And that was that was wonderful, because it's like a kind of almost like a collage of culture and society. So that was really great kind of peek into, I set out from the very beginning to cover sort of broad ground, to try to show people from different walks of life that have many different characters with many different experiences. So that book was great because it has that form of collecting a bunch of work from a variety of sources. And then along similar lines, but in the realm of fiction, was Brinlin Alexanderplatz by Alfred de Blin, which not only was really super rich with small details, you know, he'll have like a very impressionistic description of like Potsdamer plots or something, and included in it will be like a copy from newspaper, and then stuff that's on billboards, and then just an amazing, I guess I go back to this word of impressionistic feeling of the city. So it was great both in its details and also in the kind of overall feeling that it conjured. That was really huge and had a direct impact on not just the, the way that I would tell the story. I think I didn't realize that at the time, but, that book and Wings of Desire by Wim Wenders had a big impact on the, my kind of narrative approach. People sometimes describe my work as cinematic. And there are aspects of the way I tell the story that are drawn from, Berlin Alexanderplatz and Wings of Desire.
Excellent. And at this point, I was hoping we could jump into some of the content of your novel. And you have two characters around which much of the narrative revolves, Martin Müller and Kurt Severing. And the former is an art student from Cologne who's spending time in Berlin in the novel. And the latter is a journalist and a keen observer of Weimar politics. So I found both characters really empathetic. I mean, that's part of what made the novel move for me. They were, you know, total creatures of the 1920s, in my opinion. You know, I think it really, they really matched the era well. And as readers, we have this sense of impending doom. I mean, we know that these characters are headed toward a regime in which both of them would struggle terribly. But there's also a human element to the story. There's just their struggle and their sadness during a tumultuous era, of course, because part of what makes this book speak to a lot of people today. You know, they had anxiety, they had uncertainty, they had rootlessness, right? And isn't that what we're all feeling during the pandemic and, you know, various other things we've been going through? I just was curious if you could share, you know, how you created these two figures and how you successfully situated them in the Weimar era.
Yeah, it's looking back on it, it was interesting to kind of reflect on how I arrived at them, those two particular characters, and how at the time, again, there was this kind of impulsive aspect to it. But I'd done all this research, read books and books and books, and sort of absorbed all this information and kind of allowed it to percolate. And I was taking notes and making little drawings. And there was this kind of high concept approach at the beginning, which was like, okay, I don't know exactly what the content of my story is, but I know that this is this situation. I know it's starting in 1929, and I know that it's going to play out over a number of years, and that there are certain real historical events that are going to be like the tent poles that kind of hold the story up. But I didn't have a specific, you know, path that I was going to intentionally walk. I wanted to keep the story itself alive as I told it, so that if I didn't know what was going to happen next, then hopefully the reader would be along for that as well, right? So if I kept it exploratory, that the hope was that would carry over to the people who chose to read the book. So my initial high concept was I'm going to have a woman who's young and an artist, and a man who's older and a writer. Her medium is pictures and his medium is words and my medium is comics. And I'm going to, you know, the relationship between words and pictures is going to be this thing that I explore through them on the stage of Berlin. And luckily that kind of fell by the wayside pretty quickly. I think that if I had somehow tried to sustain that, it would have just been too kind of caught up in its own pretension or, you know, like working with these, with this metaphor that would kind of distract from whatever the kind of the lifeblood or the, you know, whatever that was going to move, whatever the story was going to make the story work had to be less kind of highbrow than that, less kind of distance than that. So I have a long history with tabletop role-playing games going back to Dungeons and Dragons in the 70s, late 70s. And the thing that playing those games taught me, the thing I learned was that in those games, there's different characters and you're kind of improvising interactions between these characters, not unlike improvisational theater or whatnot. But I trained those skills doing that. And in that game, you have to inhabit the kind of, you have to put yourself in the shoes of different characters all the time. So my idea was to come up with these characters that have these backgrounds, Kurt and Marta, and then kind of set them on the stage of Berlin and watch them go. And as I watched them, you know, I would shift from one to the other. And when I was with one, I'd put myself in their shoes and see what they're confronted with and make decisions according to how I think they would make decisions, and then switch back to the other character and then allow further characters to enter the story as they're encountered and they seem interesting or significant. So it was this funny kind of process where when you look at the comic, it looks incredibly, you know, I have a very, what some people call a very cold drawing style, which I don't mind being described that way. And it's very, you know, everything's in little boxes and it's very controlled and there's a fair amount of detail. So it has this very engineered aspect to it when you look at it, but the story itself and how I arrived at it came very intuitively. I followed them around. I paid attention to who they interacted with and how they responded. You know, I say this as if I wasn't the person making those decisions, but like that's how it is. Like all your characters are part of you, and you're just watching different parts of your own brain interact with itself. So that was the basic approach, and then you know, at the kind of 1/3 mark of this supposed 600 pages I was going for, was going to be the May Day demonstrations, was going to be Bloody May, and then at the 2/3 mark was going to be the elections of 1930. With those as the kind of milestones, my job was to follow these characters improvisationally from one point to the next.
All right, Jason, I have a number of questions that deal with, you know, content that come kind of from the perspective of an historian and a consumer of your work. But I wanted to give you the chance to discuss in more detail some of your artistic decisions. And while I'm a lover of graphic books, I don't claim any particular expertise there. You know, so I question my own ability to question you on the matter, but therefore I'm going to rely on someone else. I'm going to share something with you that struck me about Daniel Magalow's review of your work that appeared in the American Historical Review. I don't know if you had a chance to read it, but he noted, and I quote here, your stark black and white drawing, which evoke expressionist woodcuts. And he went on in the review to comment on how your choice to draw the book in this way, especially to draw it in black and white, it helped to draw or attract the reader to the sharp social, political, and cultural contrasts of the era. So I was wondering if you agreed with this assessment of your drawing, first of all, and if you could comment further kind of on the decision to make this a black and white book, especially.
Yeah. That was kind commentary. I wouldn't say my art is reminiscent of expressionist woodcuts. It's not expressionist really much at all. however, I do, there are some instances where I kind of, copy Franz Masuriel. I'm a great admirer of, the wordless novels of Franz Masuriel and people like Lynn Ward. My drawing itself is quite, I wouldn't say the opposite of expressionist, but it's much more in the realm of, for me, it feels like an arrangement of elements. It's not so much how the marks are made. My marks are quite, I think I approached it as a documentary film. I just wanted to sort of depict things as straightforwardly and unromantically as possible. And that the whatever kind of energy or poetry was in there came more from how things were kind of juxtaposed, as opposed to the drawing itself. To the black and white question, partly it was an economic, you know, in the early 90s, Independent comics were just mostly black and white because it was cheaper. Since then, one of the things I really value that's not connected to the economic question is when you look at a comics page, you know, it's a bunch of drawings in little boxes. And when it's just black on white, when it's just black ink on white paper, there's a couple things that are happening for me. One is there's very little distance between what I made in my studio and what the reader receives, because I'm working with black ink on white paper here, right? And then that gets sent to the printer and it gets turned into black ink on white paper. So there's a kind of more direct connection, I think, to the reader. It's very, the thing that you look at in the book is, it's shrunk down, but it's very close to the thing that's I'm looking at on my drawing table. So the color process often involves, you know, either computer color, which is a digital thing, or even if you're doing like some other form of color, it's this whole other step you go through to apply color to things. So on the one hand, I feel like it's a more kind of direct connection. And the other thing is, I feel like when it's black and white, there's more room for it to kind of speak its own language. And when the white of the page is the white you're seeing within the panels itself, then I think you're more able to kind of immerse yourself in it. When I read full color comics and there's color contained by a panel, there's a kind of distance that a greater distance that exists between me and the contents of the panel. So color comics can be beautiful and they can have a lot of emotional impact because of the colors employed. But I think along with that also comes, there's also this reproduction thing where like color reproduction often there's like an additional kind of level that comes into play there. So this is a really subtle thing I'm talking about, but and it may be a rationalization, but that's kind of how I feel about it. And I, so the initial decision was, I think, just based on the fact that it was cheaper, but in the end, I was pretty happy with it just being in black and white. And the decisions you make are all about like, it's just this binary decision, right? Like, I mean, there was shading in there in the form of cross-hatching, but like you are forced when you're just working with black and white to really kind of reduce things. And I enjoy that challenge.
Yeah. Great. And so I've got my next question is a little bit of a longer one. And, but part of it is a comment and then it leads to a question. But I think, you know, both the Trump era and the current period of global populism around the world has led to this heightened interest in the Weimar Republic. And I hope that has boosted your sales. I imagine it has, but you would know that better than me. But I noticed that right around the time when this book came out as the trilogy, the larger book, that it appeared at this almost the same time as the Netflix television series set in the Weimar period called Babylon Berlin. I really have to assume that a lot of people in the audience of a podcast called New Books in German Studies are familiar with that show. And I did notice some similarities in the narratives, which were really interesting to me. So certainly number one that really jumped out at me is this connection between Cologne and Berlin. Both in the show and in your book, you have this character who migrates from Cologne to Berlin. And in your case, that was Marta Müller. In the case of the show, which was actually based on some books, Gerion Roth is the figure in the show. But these characters, they go to Berlin and, you know, there's some culture shock or they're viewing it somewhat as an outsider to the capital city. And Berlin had this, you know, really unique, it still does today, but especially in the 20s, had this very unique status within Germany. But I've spent a lot of time in Cologne, and so I've been interested that it's viewed in this era somehow as this, you know, polar opposite of Berlin or something like that. The book also, it looks at a journalist who's trying to uncover, you know, secret plans by the military to subvert you know, peace treaties, international agreements after World War I and try to illicitly have the country rearm. That's a part of your plot and a part of the show. And then finally, both the show and your book, and this is the thing I might ask you to comment on, they both look at what in German was called Blutmai or Bloody May, and that episode is examined extensively. And so for our listeners who don't know, you know, Bloody May was this violent suppression of communist demonstrations on May Day in 1929. And this was done by the police, but it's important to understand that it was the Social Democratic Party on the left that really was in control of the suppression of this communist rally. So it really depicts a fissure on the left of the political spectrum between social democracy on the one hand and revolutionary communism on the other hand. And part of what I like about your book, right, is the way in which pictures can really, you know, capture something that it could take several pages of text to write about. So one example that I looked at in your Bloody May depiction was this image of Kurt Severing, one of your main characters, and Erwin Immenthaler, who's a less major figure, but they're both just staring at each other in such disdain as they talk about this division between the Social Democrats and the Communists. So you can really speak about any of these three overlaps that I kind of identified, or if you see others between your book and the show, but I guess I was particularly interested in hearing you talk about Bloody May as this point of focus and, you know, why that seems to really capture our imagination today in the 21st century.
Yeah. It's a bit of a blessing and a curse, and more of a curse that my book sales might have gone up thanks to the rise of populism. I remember I was finishing the last chapter during the 2016 elections, and it was like unreal to have those things happen concurrently. When I did all that research, that event really stood out to me, not just because historians, you know, had pointed to it as a kind of clear and dramatic kind of turning point, but just wondering about all the people involved, you know, wondering about what it takes to even undertake a protest of that scale, like what it means to kind of stand up to authority. There was a ban on public demonstrations that the communists violated that day, which is why the police were out in force. But, all these questions, around the same time that I was drawing that sequence, the WTO demonstrations were happening in Seattle. So like right outside my front door, very similar stuff was going down. People were having violent clashes with the police. Thankfully nobody was like shot and killed, but it had a real resonance with my actual day-to-day life at the time. It's this kind of touchstone. It's it has all the elements that you describe, and researching it, I just became interested in trying to figure out how it happened. These things don't ever go as planned, and they don't ever, the insurrection in our own country that happened on January 6th, similar a situation, but kind of flipped where the police just were not equipped to deal with the problem.
Yeah.
So it's messy, and I was interested in that, right? It happened on a great, and it, as an illustration, as a kind of expression of the frustrations and, there's political ideology, but there's also just individual personal choices and frustrations in trying to act on those. How does the individual contribute to this larger thing? And then what are the circumstances that contribute to it becoming such a disaster? That all became super interesting to me. It's funny about Volker Kutscher and his books that Babylon Berlin is based on. He actually was reader of my comic in the 90s. He's actually a big comics fan, and my comic had been published in Germany in translation. And he has admitted to me that it was a little bit of an inspiration for his own books.
Interesting.
My depiction of Bloody May had an effect on his approach to it, which is totally bizarre, because that's like, here I am, like at that point I was in my late 20s, living in Seattle, Washington, never even been to Germany, and somebody in Germany was reading my book and like finding something of interest in it, which was incredibly gratifying to hear. I met him a couple years ago when I toured with my book over there. He's a lovely man. So there was a little bit of a, but not only, so it's not that, I'm not saying that like his books were inspired by mine at all, but he does say that they influenced his approach to some of the material. I think that generationally, so him and I are roughly the same age, and I think that there's this kind of, especially in Germany, this desire to come to terms with these historical events, right? His approach was through a kind of more of a pulpy murder mystery kind of style novel, and but I think that it's not a coincidence that he and I both became fascinated in this subject. Him, there's definitely overlap in our reasons, but for him, there's of course this deep kind of cultural connection to it. And as I mentioned, that was one of the two kind of main tent poles of the story. I was working towards that event happening. So how I got there and how the characters got there was something I figured out kind of one page at a time. But I always knew that that was going to be the end of at the end of eight chapters that was going to happen. So I had to kind of get to that point. And I think the bigger question, you know, that whole struggle, like the potential of the Weimar Republic and how it fell apart horrifically, it was fascinating to me to come to understand that, like, in the void left by a monarchy, right, in the vacuum of a authoritarian state, like, what happens? Like, it turns out that a lot of people don't want to think for themselves. It turns out that a lot of people like to be told that somebody else is going to make the decisions for them. And as long as you're on board with that and you agree that you and your tribe are superior to everyone else, then, you know, the people that are pulling those levers of power can get away with a lot. And it was more complicated then, just because of, you know, I think in the Reichstag at that point, there were something like, I can't remember the numbers now, but it's like 26 different political parties or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's wild.
I mean, it's just, that was another thing that just blew my mind, right? Like, there was a political party for every segment of the population. And that was one of the things Hitler used as a, you know, he said, can you believe this? We are not 26, we're one Germany, right? Like playing upon that need that people have to be like all on this, all agreeing and moving forward for some joint effort, like for some cause that everybody wants to believe in. All of that stuff was super fascinating to me because I was just like a white kid from the suburbs who, you know, had never really even thought about that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was really interesting to hear about your connection to Babylon Berlin, actually, that it wasn't just a happenstance, that there are some similarities there.
My favorite thing, if I can interrupt you, Michael, for a second.
Yeah, please.
I was at a punk rock vegan basement bar in Hanover, I think, and doing like a book signing, and a young guy, he must have been 27 or 28 years old, came up to me afterwards and like got my book signed. You know, he had me sign my book and he's like, hey, I'm the visual effects supervisor for Babylon Berlin. And I was like, what? Are you kidding me? And he's like, yeah. He said, and I want you to know, I think that your depiction of the May Day massacre was better than ours.
Well, that's great. That's quite a compliment. Yeah, you know,
incredibly kind of that a point of pride.
It's like getting some of the inside baseball stories here. I want to move on to one other, or not just one other, but another topic here. And one of the things that, you know, compelled me about the book is that it, treats sexuality pretty effectively. And I've featured a number of scholars on this podcast, who study sexuality, people like Lori Marhoefer, or recently I did an interview with Javier Semper Vendrell and Clayton Wisnant and Heike Bauer and several others actually. And so you feature queer sexuality in your depiction of the relationship between Marta Muller and Anna Lenka. And in the process, you're able to kind of put a spotlight on the impact of paragraph 175. So, you know, I might have you talk about that, but but sexuality is just kind of a broader theme anyway. You know, you have kind of another maybe transgressive relationship between Paula Mossett and Kid Hogan, which is transgressive because it was an interracial relationship. And I might have been projecting as I was reading the book, you know, because I'm interested in this aspect of the era, but it seemed like, you know, you were also capturing this tension between some of the momentum, which is very complicated, but, you know, toward progressive viewpoints on sex that was going on, especially in Berlin and other cities, and then the backlash against that as well. But I just more than anything, I'd be curious to get your thoughts on why you made sexuality such a central part of the book, what inspired you to do that, and why you thought you did it well.
I think the other thing that happened when I was just making plans before I drew the first page, I was making I was thinking about how I wanted to approach the story overall, and like I said, I had this kind of notion that Kurt and Marta would be words and pictures, and then the other thing I did was I made lists of the kinds of things I wanted in the story, and I think because I was so excited about the potential of comics I also wanted to explore that potential, and I wanted to figure out like what kinds of things how would comics be used to address a variety of subjects, and I had lists of things like the five senses, you know, sight, smell, hearing, touch, taste, maybe the sixth sense, right? Such like some other kind of form of perception. How do you use comics to show what an apple pie smells like? You know what I mean? Like, how do I use this medium to conjure these different things? And among the, I think the goal was like to create as rich a portrait of human experience as I was capable of. And one really big part of that, and one really, to my mind, very interesting and compelling part of that is sexuality and how people figure out who they are, personal identity, and how they express that. It was just something that, I guess, something that's always been interesting to me as an adult, something that I did a fair amount of exploring myself with in my college years. And then when I was living in Seattle in the 90s, there was like a really thriving art and queer scene. And I was involved in that. And since that was sort of all in the hopper, it all kind of, I think, emerged naturally as I told this story. Like, because I had this improvisational approach, certain characters get into situations or express, you know, you see them engaging with or expressing or trying to figure out their sexuality in the course of the story, because I felt like that's where they were at. And it was just part of the palette, you know, it was like in all the kind of spectrum of human experience, that's a big part of it that in my experience growing up wasn't really talked about, you know, like, so I wanted to kind of get into that and do the same thing I described before, which is like put myself in those people's shoes. Like, there's a member of Kid Hogan's band who's gay, and he finds himself in Berlin, which was like a thriving gay, you know, home of the first gay village in the world. And and this black man from America finds himself there. And like, what, you know, like, what's he going to feel like in that situation? I'm also fascinated by cities as places where populations gather, and people from outside of the city come to the city to find people like them, like themselves, to find their social or cultural or gender identity group, right? Like when you grow up in a small town and you're like the only gay person you know of, then moving to a city allows you to meet up with those people. So the whole what a city is, every aspect of what a city is was totally fascinating to me, how a city grows up, the organic nature of a city, regardless of the amount of planning that goes into it, how it just kind of grows out on its own. And then these communities, these human communities that form when they find each other, all that was super interesting. And there, you know, there are a few kind of greater examples of that in Berlin in the 20s than people who were engaged with, you know, there was the Institute, I can't remember the name of the Institute.
Magnus Hirschfeld.
Yeah, that one. Yeah. And mm-hmm. It was just among the stuff that I read when I was researching. It just sort of naturally rose to the surface as a subject that I wanted to engage with, and not, you know, clearly connected to everything else that was going on at the time too, right? Like,
yeah,
when you kind of work against or express yourself against the norms of your culture, you know, first of all, it's interesting that a place existed where you could do that. And then, but then of course, eventually you are going to run up against the oppression that stuff that historically has accompanied that stuff. So it was just one of those things I was interested in. I find, you know, that subject endlessly fascinating. And I wanted to take a couple different, you know, in the end, is Marta a lesbian? Marta's one of these people whose maybe identity is not super defined. And that was interesting too. Like, not only is she exploring that, but also for women in Berlin, in Germany at the time, they had all these options that they hadn't 10 years before. So,
yeah.
And that's part of that, this kind of opening up of possibility. And I think generally speaking, the work that I'm most excited about when I'm making art is something with this sense of possibility and potential. And I think Berlin is like such an amazing example of that, like a place that is so, at that time, was so full of possibility for so many people in so many different ways. And it went a particular way, but in that period of time, and I think I relate this to my experience in Seattle in the 90s when like the music scene was taking off, and there's some kind of resonance between those two things. That's the stuff that I'm really compelled by.
Well, I'm going to take you from a sense of possibility to tragedy here. I was really struck by how you opened the book with this image of a member of the National Socialist Party sleeping on a train, right? Like, you had this sleeping menace, you know, that we all knew was going to emerge by the end. But again, it's just one of these frames from the book that you know, just captures things, right, in a way that it would be difficult to do with text. And of course, the book ends with a number of your protagonists, you know, in despair, Kurt Severing particularly, along the way, we get a sense of how the party appealed to certain characters. I'll give you a chance to take a whack at, you know, the million-dollar question, but, you know, how does your vision of Berlin in the 20s help us to understand why the Weimar experiment failed and ended so tragically with Hitler's rise to power?
Oh, my God, that's a big question.
You can feel free to just tell me to go away.
I think a lot of people have written more in depth on that subject. It's interesting that this book gets taught in history classes and that it won that award for that you mentioned at the top of the top of the hour. I'm not a historian, and I'm not coming at it from the artist angle. It's like you have all this stuff that you're engaging with, and it feels exploratory, and it feels like, yeah, I'm trying to come to an understanding, but by no means did I arrive at any answers to those kinds of questions, right? Like, what could have happened? Well, I guess maybe the terms of the Treaty of Versailles could have been less onerous. Maybe if Germany had not been, you know, like deeply punished for its actions, maybe it wouldn't have come back with such vengeance. Like, there's just any number of factors, right? There's unfortunately no way that I could answer that. And it's been absolutely soul wracking and intense to watch the stuff that's been playing out in our own country in the past 4 years. And to see the ways to see the resonances that exist, to see the connections between, you know, Stephen Miller, who I think of as like a reincarnation of Joseph Goebbels, and then these things that are totally different and totally couldn't have happened then, and to see how, things like the technology of our time has completely affected the way that all works, and to think about how the technology of that time had similar impacts in a different way. I am not the person to answer that question.
In some ways, I think it might be interesting, you know, as someone who didn't come into it with a clear theory of the case, like many historians do, and we all argue about this. None of us really can reach consensus, you know, but you, like, the, you know, if you just think about Kurt Severing's, kind of helpless observation, right, of everything falling apart, you know, everything that he valued falling apart. And you could just so, or at least I could so empathize, right, with this keen observer of politics who cared so deeply, right, and just, you know, falling into despair over what was happening, that, you know, maybe not having a theory of the case helped you capture that even more clearly.
Yeah, I mean, I read everything that was out there about, you know, people looking back and trying to kind of take it all apart and come up with some answers. And yeah. There's a lot of, you know, interesting and good stuff out there, but I never got to the point, and I still don't feel like I'm at the point where I could. my kind of the thing that I end up, my whole relationship to this stuff is very experiential. It's very, you know, like when I, over the course of writing the book, most of my studios were in the basement, and every time I'd get my morning cup of coffee and go down the stairs. And when I went down the stairs, I was going back in time, and I was going into my own unconscious, right? I was tapping into mm-hmm. not only like the stuff that I had read, the kind of conscious things I had absorbed intellectually, but like my sense and my feeling about what might have been going on at the time and how that related to my own moment. So processing all of that, it all happens on like, it doesn't happen on this kind of intellectual level where I can even articulate. It's all in the realm of feeling. And so, I mean, it occurred in a lot of ways. If there's any character in the book that reflects my own, perspective or my own personality, it would be him. The Kurt and Marta both, kind of have aspects that are very much like me, but when he's in those moments of despair, that's definitely you know, that purple prose that comes out of him is me talking. I think the impression that I get, you know, like people, as you can imagine on the book tours I've done, people have been like, what parallels do you see between the contents of your book and what's happening in the world today? And you can point to parallels, but like the thing that I end up feeling is like this force, this aspect of human nature, which has been present throughout history and kind of rose and dominated during that time and then was like pushed down. Like I see it like a giant snake moving through time. And that snake was pushed out of sight and then gradually kind of rose up again and came back with a vengeance, as we've seen, and for so many different factors, which I can't go into here, but that's this kind of sense that I had. And I think that when I was going down my basement and traveling back in time and tapping into that, I was kind of feeling the movement of that snake. Like I was sensing the kind of vibrations of that creature as it moved through our world. And how to like get a handle on it at root. It's just like how to do something about that now. You know, it's the fifth element.
Yeah.
It's love. I'm a total hippie in that respect, but like, you know that Donald Trump never got any love growing up. It's had horrible repercussions for the world. How you find it in your heart to find love for a proud boy, I don't know.
All right. So I do want to ask you a little bit about the possibilities of this book for the classroom. And I really like, if people in our audience are like me, you know, and they probably have already used graphic resources in their courses. I really enjoy it. You know, I've used classics like Art Spiegelman's Mouse, but I've also gotten into, you know, Oxford University Press has this series of graphic histories where scholars get paired with this graphic artist, Liz Clark. And so, you know, Trevor Goetz's A Being in the Important Men, I just thought was brilliant. And then there've been others in that series, Ronald Schechter's Mendoza the Jew and Michael Vann's The Great Hanoi Rat Hunt. I like consuming this stuff. I like Joe Sacco's work and Marjane Satrapi's Persepolis is interesting. There's a new one. I can't remember the name of the author. Two new ones actually on Rosa Luxemburg and another one on Hannah Arendt. So it's just my sense that graphic books are being used more in the classroom now than it most times in the past. Maybe I'm wrong about that.
You know, You're absolutely right.
Yeah. But I was wondering, do you have a good story like from someone who's used your book, or have you heard about someone who's used it in an interesting way?
I showed up for, I've spoken to classes in different places at different times. I mean, generally it's part of like a history curriculum or, sometimes it's, you know, the nice thing about it is that it does seem to get applied in a variety of ways, which is really, really great. I haven't encountered anything that was particularly inspiring. It's all been really, it's all crazy because it's so unexpected. Like when I set out to make this thing, I wasn't ever imagining it would go anywhere. So to see it, to have it be taught in classrooms by people who I respect is really remarkable to me. I think the most interesting one that I encountered was somebody teaching at Bennington who was using it as a text to explore architectural spaces.
Huh, interesting.
Which is not something that, you know, I draw a lot of buildings. that's true. And it's almost all of my buildings are based on, you know, actual buildings that I could find reference for. But the focus, I think it was actually, if I'm remembering right, it was a German class, like a German language class, and they were using the book, you know, to help people with the whole book would happen in the whole class would happen in German. And, but the thing that they were using my book to discuss was, built spaces and how people move through them and the effect that they have on something like a visual narrative like that. So that was kind of the most, you know, kind of out there example.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, at this point, I've really taken up a lot of your time today, so I'm going to end with a traditional New Books Network question. And we always like to ask people what they're working on now, but of course, I'm always a little cautious during the pandemic since everyone's lives have been so disrupted. I don't know if people are able to work on the projects they want to work on, but are you working on something interesting now? And if the pandemic has permitted you to work on something new?
Yeah, well, I'm really fortunate in that a cartoonist's life, you know, the difference in my life pre and in pandemic is not that great. <There's> not much I work in my house most of the time. I don't see a lot of people besides my family. I do teach at a place called the Center for Cartoon Studies, and thankfully we were able to continue in-person meeting according to Vermont state guidelines. So my job still is intact, and I've been able to maintain that stuff. So my life hasn't really changed that much, you know, beyond like looking for trying to buy toilet paper and yeast like everybody else. the thing I'm working on now, right now, at the immediate moment, I'm trying to crowdfund two role-playing game projects, which is kind of like a side passion of mine. But my next graphic novel is also on the drawing table, and that is... it's going to be much shorter, and it's going to be in color. So this is running against my whole idea that like black and white is the best. I've never done a full color comic of any length, so I'm interested in that. And it takes place in Arizona in 1865. And it follows, I grew up reading Western comics, and I'm interested in the Western as a genre, except that I want to kind of deconstruct it and tell a story from the point of view of the people who are usually in the background of traditional Western stories. So the main character is a 16-year-old Mexican-Irish girl, and it's just about her adventures as she and some friends try to go warn Geronimo that the U.S. Army is coming for him.
Wow.
And it's great because I don't have to draw any buildings. It's all desert.
No more architectural classrooms for that one, huh?
That's right. I think there's going to be a couple of tents at the most. But I do have to learn how to draw horses. That's the hard part.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating project. So I'll look forward to seeing that and reading that when it comes out. And I just want to, at this point, thank you for giving us your time today, Jason. And thanks for being on the show.
It was my pleasure, Michael.
Great. And to our audience, you've been listening to an episode in New Books in German Studies, a channel in the New Books Network of Podcasts. My name is Michael O'Sullivan, and our guest today was Jason Lutz. We discussed his recent book entitled Berlin, published with Drawn and Quarterly in 2019. I hope that all of our listeners are as well as can be expected in the circumstances. Please stay healthy, and thank you for tuning in, and we hope you'll continue to listen.